Last week on the show, we explored the genetics of breast cancer. The BRCA1 and 2 breast cancer genes have recently found themselves the focus of international attention following Angelina Jolie's announcement that she'd had a preventative double mastectomy after she found a mutation on the BRCA1 gene. Well, this week, BRCA1 and 2 are back in the spotlight. They're the genes at the centre of a patent dispute, and on Friday, the US Supreme Court handed down its ruling in the case. I caught up with Diane Nicol, a professor of law from the University of Tasmania, to bring us up to speed with that court case and to let us know how these issues might play out at home.
It's actually really quite complicated because this particular case involves genes that are related to increased predisposition to breast cancer. So there's two genes, one called BRCA1 and the other called BRCA2. And they were discovered and patented and owned by a company called Myriad Genetics, which is based in Utah in the US. The patents were challenged by a few non-profit organisations and clinicians on the basis that they were interfering with their capacity to deliver diagnostic tests. And the challenge came about in 2009, I believe, and it's been going through the US court system in a very erratic way in some respects. So there was a decision in 2010 from the district court, a judge called Justice Sweet, who decided that the entirety of these patents were invalid. So that covered gene sequences that were exactly the same as the gene sequences in the natural world, gene sequences that were different but carried out the same function, methods using those gene sequences for diagnosis, for predisposition to cancer, and so on. So that happened in 2010. And then Myriad Genetics, of course, appealed. So there's an appeal court in the US called the Federal Circuit. And that court decided that some aspects of the patents were invalid, some aspects were valid. And there was sort of a bit of a mixed decision. So there were three judges. Two judges thought that the act of isolating these gene sequences from the natural world was enough. A lot of the debate is around the nature of DNA. Is it chemical or informational? The other judge, the dissenting judge, said, how can these be patentable? It's just like snapping a leaf off a tree. And snapping of a leaf off a tree became very much the analogy that was used by many commentators in this area. Now, because of the complexities of the court system in the US, it ended up back in the same court and they made the same decision. But finally, it got to the Supreme Court, which is the highest US court. So this was the definitive ruling, at least on these particular patents. And the hearing for that was a couple of months ago, and they handed down their decision. And basically, they drew a clear distinction between sequences that are identical to those that exist in the natural world and sequences that are different. So the sequences that are different are really based on the way DNA is transcribed into messenger RNA and proteins. And in that transcription process from DNA to RNA, some of the components of the gene sequence are lost. One of the techniques that's often used when you're working out what a gene sequence is to do the reverse of this transcription process. So essentially, you're copying that changed RNA back into DNA, and it's often referred to as cDNA or complementary DNA. So the judges in the Supreme Court basically said that this complementary DNA is patentable, but the DNA that's identical to the natural DNA, often called gDNA, is not patentable.
In real-world terms, though, what does the ruling mean, like for healthcare and for research? How's this ruling going to impact those domains?
It's not absolutely clear at the moment, because naturally occurring sequences are really important when you're doing diagnostic testing, and particularly, for example, when you're doing whole genome sequencing. There's a thought there that it might well open up the diagnostic testing market. at least when you're looking at whether or not you're infringing a patent claim relating to isolated sequences. Of course, the big problem is that it's never this simple. When you've got a particular patent, it might have 40 or 50 different claims, some of which will claim the isolated naturally occurring sequence, some will claim cDNA, others will claim methods of using those sequences. Earlier decisions in this case have said that some of those methods are not valid, but other ones might still be valid. So there's still potentially impediments there in relation to breast cancer testing. So I think that it will take a little while to sort out exactly what's been freed up and what hasn't been freed up. The important thing for a lot of people is it's more that symbolic thing that genes as they exist in nature are not patentable.
It's impressive how that symbolism has resonated around the globe today.
Oh, it certainly has. And, you know, it reflects the genuine beliefs of many scientists. You know, when I talk to scientists, it's inconceivable for them that these patents were ever granted. But patenting of these sorts of things have been around for the last 30 or so years. So it's taken a long time to get to this point.
Now, there's a similar court case currently running in Australia. And in February, the Australian court ruled that a mutation on the BRCA1 gene could be patented. Can you tell us a little bit about this case?
It's interesting because, of course, patents are only granted nationally. So the US decision relates only to the US patents. And although there's international laws that harmonise patent law to a certain extent, there's still very different nuances between countries. Some of the patents, at least, have also been granted in Australia. And the one relating to BRCA1 is the one that was challenged in the Australian case as well. The court in this case was just looking at the specific question of whether those gene sequences that are identical to the ones that exist in nature fulfill this threshold requirement of being patentable subject matter. And there's a test in Australia that is whether you've got an artificially created state of affairs. In this case involving an organisation called Cancer Voices Australia, the judge said that the fact that you've got this isolated gene sequence outside of human cells is enough for it to be an artificially created state of affairs. So the removal from cells takes it outside of the natural environment. This case too has been appealed, but the Federal Court of Appeal hasn't even heard that case yet.
Now, there are different legal systems, of course, and mm-hmm. different patent law between Australia and the mm-hmm. US, but to what extent do you think this US decision is going to influence the appeal in the Australian courts?
Look, I think it will be interesting to see what influence it does have. Certainly, we have our own body of case law that interprets our Australian patent legislation. But because there's no clear guidance from that case law on how you apply this doctrine of artificially created state of affairs to isolated biological materials, like whether they be genes or proteins or any of those sorts of subject matter, the court is likely to look for guidance from other jurisdictions. So I certainly think that the court will look very closely at the US Supreme Court decision and will have to decide whether they can rely on that or whether the Australian requirements are so fundamentally different that it's not going to provide that level of guidance.
The scope of these decisions is quite far-reaching. While most people's gut feeling seems to be that you shouldn't be able to patent human genes, it's important to strike a balance where research and biotech innovation are still encouraged, and that's really the role of patents, to encourage innovation. How do you see the potential outcomes in Australia playing out?
That's absolutely right. You have to look at what the purpose of the patent system is for. It is to encourage innovation. And Australia has put great store in its biomedical research and its biotechnology research. The sorts of genetic research that are going on in Australia are obviously important in terms of human health, But we also have a very active biotechnology industry in terms of plant genetics and animal genetics and the like. There's a lot of concern, certainly in the agricultural biotechnology sector, that if you have a broad decision about gene patents, it could in fact have a deterrent effect on innovation in that sector. In medical biotechnology, there are a large number of medical biotech firms in Australia, and they're actively involved in cancer research, vaccine research, aging research, and so on. So I guess for them, the concern is that it might be a deterrent in terms of getting investment in research that takes those basic scientific results through to usable products.
Genetic research is one of the most rapidly developing areas of science. How do you see this issue of gene patenting playing out over the next 5 or 10 years?
To some extent, I think that the gene patent debate has played out in the 1990s and the technology has moved on. There are many new techniques now that don't rely on having the isolated gene sequence. So, for example, whole genome sequencing, there is no isolation phase. And a lot of the information about human DNA is known and it's publicly available. So in some respects, although there are problematic gene patents already in existence, it would be much harder to get anything like those sort of broad patents now and into the future. So, for example, Myriad's patent only has another couple of years to go before it expires. Patents last for 20 years. A lot of these are coming to the end of their life. And as soon as a patent expires, then the information contained in it becomes publicly available. So in some respects, I'm optimistic, irrespective of what the court decision is in Australia, it may well be that the perceived fetters that gene patents bring are already being worked out because of improvements in technology, because patents are expiring, and because the patent officers around the world are becoming much more sophisticated when they're examining these patents and deciding what is allowable, what can and can't be patented, and what the scope is as to what you can and can't claim.
Professor of Law Diane Nicol. Tune in to Life Matters tomorrow morning when Natasha Mitchell and the team try to answer the question, who owns your genes? It's the ethics of whole genome sequencing here on RN at 9 a.m. Australian Eastern Time.